everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. Happy New Year! It's January 2025, and this is a whole new year of Postmodern Realities Podcasts, and you are listening to episode 427, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the Apple TV Plus series called Sunny. On this episode, I'm joined by Lisa Cooper. She is a marketing specialist at Paravel Insights and a freelance writer with Barna. Lisa has a master's degree in religion from the American Lutheran Theological Seminary, and she also serves as an adjunct chaplain at Chesterton House at Cornell University in New York. Lisa has written an online exclusive TV series review for the Christian Research Journal, and her review is called Grief, Loneliness, Friendship, and Robots: How Apple TV Plus's Sunny Shows Us About Human Nature. And you can read it absolutely free online at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Lisa, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Well, last summer in July or so, I noticed that there was a trending TV series on Apple Plus TV, and it was called Susie, and I like sci-fi. So I didn't really know anything about it. It said it's a sci-fi series, and I was making a trip, and so I had time on my hands to watch it on the long plane flight. So I started watching it. I'm like, wow, this is really weird. It got weirder. And I was thinking, this is something we need to cover, mainly because it is popular. People are watching it. And there's a lot to be said about some of the themes that come through. So this series is actually based on a 2018 novel called The Dark Manual. And it was written by award-winning Irish writer Colin O'Sullivan, who is actually an expat, and he's lived in Japan for more than 20 years. So more than 20 years ago, Colin went there, I guess, after university. He thought, I'll teach English for a year. And he ended up meeting his wife, Yuki. I remember her name because that's my dog's name, Yuki. And now he's been there for 20 years and raising his family there. And he has said he loves writing, has written since he was a little kid. So now he's writing about Japan. So in this book and TV series, this American woman named Susie is living in Kyoto, Japan, and she has a Japanese husband who she met in Japan, and she has a young son, and they get onto a plane, and the plane crashes, but they vanish. So everybody's kind of accounted for, but her son and husband aren't accounted for. And as kind of a bereavement gift, her husband, who worked at an electronics company, their company sends her this domestic robot. And so that's kind of what happens. And then also, there are 10 episodes on Apple Plus TV, but only 4 of them are based on the book. So when I was reading an interview with Colin O'Sullivan, he was kind of looking forward to seeing, well, what twists did they do with his book? And there are quite a few twists, and we're going to talk about that because some of our conversation towards the end of the series is what was introduced by the writer of the TV series. So I mentioned it's about a woman named Susie. Her name is Susie Sakamoto because she's married to a Japanese man. And so what is her life like when we meet her and she has received this domestic robot whose name is Sunny? That's the name of the series. And what are some of the unique challenges, just as we get dropped into this, you know, situation in her life that Susie Sakamoto faces?
Yeah, so Susie is an expat, just like Colin O'Sullivan, and she does not know Japanese very well. She knows a little bit, but mostly in order to like insult people or swear at them. That seems to be the way she uses her Japanese when we see her. But she has the benefit of this like translator earpiece that she uses all the time. And she blames her dyslexia for not being able to converse with people in Japanese. So part of it is that there's this learning difficulty that she has. And part of it is this kind of reluctance to really embrace the culture around her. So that's a unique challenge that she faces. And I think this really comes from the author of the book. He also has an elementary understanding of Japanese after living there for 20 years. And so he actually writes, there's this quote, he says, the difficulties with language, the reluctance or the hesitancy, it's a difficult language. I speak elementary Japanese, enough to get around and survive, but I don't read and write well. So there's a lot of me in Susie. And then, of course, there's the Irish drinking going on with Susie as well. So we do see a little bit of the author reflected in Susie's character in this way.
There's a lot of drinking, I will say.
There's a lot of drinking. And so that is one of the things.
I felt like Susie's at the bar a lot. There's a lot of drinking involved.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of drinking in isolation, too, which it indicates to me more of a substance abuse issue, more so than just social drinking. But anyway, when we meet her, she is already lonely and isolated before the plane crash and before her husband and son are presumed dead. So she lives in this sprawling house, but there are comments made, you know, she doesn't have friends. She doesn't know anyone. She's never really plugged into the community. And at the same time, the family that she has nearby, her mother-in-law, Noriko, is very dismissive and not warm toward her. She sort of sees her as a problem in her life. And so her family relationships are strained, like extended family. And now her only people that she had in the world are now presumed dead in the plane crash. And so there's like language difficulties. There's this substance use disorder that seems to be kind of lingering in the background where she's constantly going back to drinking no matter the circumstance. So drinking, you know, before the funeral, during the funeral, after the funeral of her husband that her mother-in-law kind of throws. It is just, there are a lot of complicating factors that kind of go into her difficult situation at the time of the plane crash. But we see somebody who's already kind of primed for grief, isolation, and doesn't have human connections in the way that she needs in order to kind of survive this tragedy that's happened.
So it is kind of an interesting, you know, you just kind of get dropped into her situation. And one thing I will say, because as someone who's Japanese, I know a little bit about Japanese culture, but honestly, part of the reason why she's isolated is her husband works quite a bit, or did before, and that's very typical of Japanese work culture. Yes. I don't know if they show this with her husband, but I would just say not Japanese work culture also, but Asian work culture. This is also true in China, because I hosted a Chinese exchange student for a few years, and he was telling me about his parents' situation and his dad, who, and this is true in the Japanese culture, is every day after work, you go to dinner and drinking with your boss. I mean, you're required. You know, they don't write it in your contract, but you can't not go. You do. And so the hard part, I think maybe she wasn't realizing this character, is that Japanese women are basically like single moms because their husband works all the time, even if they don't go drinking. And it's interesting, I knew a young mom, she had one son, kind of set up like this, and she was learning English through a church down the street from my church, and someone from my church volunteered at the other church because she used to be a missionary, and so she was trying to find friends for this young mom who was very isolated in North Carolina, and there were a bunch of expat Japanese working for Japanese companies here, and so she would be alone all the time. And the only time her husband would take off is Sunday. And even at night, he wouldn't come home. He'd work until, they didn't go drinking in, you know, North Carolina, but they would work till 10 p.m. And I said, do the Americans do that? And she said, no, just the Japanese. And he would work on Saturday too.
Wow.
So it's very much like, even if they're not in Japan, they're still doing that. So that's part of, you know, she's isolated and lonely, but she's by herself. And that's because her husband, you know, the plot will thicken because a lot involves his work, but that is not atypical. It's not necessarily, oh, this is for the plot for this book. It is Japanese culture. You do go out every, you eat dinner with your coworkers and your boss and you go out drinking. I don't know if it's every night, but it's quite frequently, so much so that the Japanese women keep, the moms keep their own schedule with the children. And really the dad, they don't see them very often.
Yeah.
So there's kind of some of that as background. So this TV series is named Sunny, and I didn't realize when I first started it that it's a character. And we meet this character in the first episode, and I mentioned that it's a domestic robot from her husband's technology company. So can you explain why Sunny is important, and how does Susie relate to this domestic robot?
So Sunny, she's a very interesting character because it's kind of the first time we see a character pop up that's not human, that really seems like she has human affection. So Sunny is a robot that is created specifically for Susie by her husband, Masa. This mysterious man shows up and drops Sunny off and says, you know, here's your new domestic robot. It's from your husband. Not only does Susie hate robots, she kind of credits robots with her mother's death, which we find out is like a self-driving car accident. And the mother-in-law, of course, makes a comment like, oh, it was user error or something. So to diminish her pain and worry about, you know, robots. But basically, Susie gets this robot and as a homebot, Sunny is supposed to be helpful, like around the house. She's capable of making food and cleaning things up, and that's sort of the ideal of what a homebot is supposed to be. But there's something really unique about this robot in that it genuinely seems interested in cultivating a relationship with Susie. And the man who drops off the robot, we find out later, this is going to be full of spoilers. I hope that's okay. We find out later that it's this man is Yuki, Masa's real father. And so this mysterious man says that this robot was designed specifically for Susie. So this robot is specifically created to care and want to be around Susie and wants to cultivate a relationship with her. So at first we see Susie not wanting anything to do with Sunny. She turns her off and hides her in a closet and doesn't want to be around her. And so Sunny keeps trying to like insert herself and be helpful and do the things that she's programmed to do. But Susie doesn't want anything to do with her. And we see this kind of strained attempt by this robot to forge an emotional and relational bond with Susie that Susie has no interest in doing or having with her. And it's not until Susie finds out that Sunny, kind of in her, you know, hard drive or whatever, there's some latent memories of her husband, of Susie's husband, Masa, that she wants to keep her around and find out as much as she can about her husband through this robot. So it's interesting because you see not only this like desperation for a relationship from a robot, like this robot is really desperately trying to cultivate a relationship with Susie, but she's also willing to like lie and try to deny her programming that doesn't allow her to do that, lie and steal to help Susie. As she finds out more and more that Susie's trying to find out more about her husband. So it's interesting how like we see a robot who exhibits these like clear kind of human problems, wanting a relationship, not being able to have it, feeling that kind of emotional turmoil, and being willing to sacrifice things and lie and cheat and steal in order to, you know, make whatever Susie wants happen.
Happy New Year. It's 2025, and I can't believe we're on our way to 450 episodes of the Postmodern Realities podcast this year. And you can look forward every week to getting a new episode with one of our authors and something that they've written for us. Sometimes we have some bonus episodes that are audio only, but we have a lot of very interesting topics that we're going to cover. Of course, all of the cultural apologetics that you receive from the Postmodern Realities podcast. But we also want to have a conversation with you. So I guess a few months ago, I mentioned that we do have letters to the editor still, and we can put those underneath articles if you want to send one in, if something strikes you as you're listening to the podcast. And you can do that by emailing response@equip.org. That's response@equip.org. So if you also want to do something more immediate, every single Postmodern Realities podcast episode is also on our Bible Answer Man YouTube channel. I don't know if you know about that channel. It has more than 3,000 videos there. We have our PMR, as we like to shorten it, episodes there. And if there's something that you want to comment on when you listen to an episode, please head on over to YouTube and comment there. And one of our research staff will interact with your comments if you have more questions or you want to make a statement, or maybe you even disagreed with something that we said in the podcast. Please feel free to post it there. That's a good way to interact with comments that you may have. And I'd also like to invite you to suggest topics. What kind of topics would you like to hear more about on this podcast? Is there a particular book or film or TV series that we don't know about or we really need to cover for the podcast that you think every Christian apologist really needs to know how to answer because it's trending or it's something that people are talking about? Maybe that would even apply to music or other cultural types of things that we haven't really discussed much, but we need to start covering on this podcast. I think we've only done one episode in almost 450 episodes on sports. So really, there's all kinds of different topics. What would you like to hear more about? What do you want us to fill gaps in? One thing that Lisa Cooper will be back later this year to talk to us about is, as I mentioned in her bio at the top of the podcast, is she is a freelance writer with Barna and has done a lot of research on Gen Z. And there is a trend right now that I've seen covered in the New York Times that shows that the gender that is deconverting and moving away from Christianity fastest is women. So what are women in their 20s thinking about? Why are they leaving Christianity? And we're going to cover that in an article and a podcast conversation. So please tune in this year. Please interact with us online on YouTube. Send us an email, a letter to the editor. But also, it's a new year. We didn't get as many comments that I hoped for the end of the year. It's been a while. So please give us a review or a like, especially in Apple Podcasts. Did you know that the top two platforms where people get all of their podcasts is Spotify and Apple, and particularly Apple? So if you could go onto Apple and give us a comment why you like listening to the podcast and a review, it really helps us out and helps more people discover this podcast. So back to my conversation with Lisa Cooper, and Happy New Year again to you and yours. Well, the setting of this TV series in Japan is like, kind of, you realize it's the not so distant future, but there are still some like sci-fi and dystopian elements that show up in the show. And I do say it's this not so distant future because earlier this fall, I got to ride in a self-driving car in San Francisco called a Waymo. It was like the first rollout of it. So, you know, it's made by Google, and I know someone at Google, and so they were, you know, given the opportunity to use it. And at first, it seems very freaky, but I have to say it's probably going to be the future because the Waymos have next to no accidents, and the one accident that it actually had was literally the other driver, like human error from the other driver, not the Waymo itself.
Yeah.
And it is very surrealistic. I mean, you get into it, it knows your name, because you have, you know, on the app, you call the Waymo and they're just kind of driving around San Francisco. There's 300 of them driving around their electric cars, but they have more than, you know, obviously they have GPS and all those things, but they have other aspects to it. So it has infrared, so it can sense if somebody like darts out in the street in front of it. And there were people jaywalking when I was taking it, and it just completely stopped. It knew it to slow down and stop. The first time you take it, I took it twice. You have that sensation, you know, if somebody else is driving, you're still watching how they're turning and you're trying not to backseat drive, like, whoa, slow down or whatever. But it just does everything so perfectly. It parks perfectly that by the second time, it's almost like a relaxing spa experience you get in. You can't really hear outside noise. It's speaking to you kind of in the same similar voice that Sunny has, in this just very soothing woman's voice. And the temperature is just perfect. And they've got, you know, ambient music playing. And so we see it set in the not so distant future, but I just rode a self-driving car. So it is right. The fact that there could be home robots is probably not too far off. I mean, there are probably some just basic ones right now, but there could be, you know, an example of something like Sunny showing up. So how does this series, you know, and it does definitely have some dystopian, like sci-fi elements to it that aren't true for now, but how do they comment on our use and abuse of technology? And I will say, though, because if anyone watched the travel show of the late Anthony Bourdain, there's an episode where he goes to Japan and you can watch robots fight, like ringside fighting between these different robots. And you have these women, I guess, in bikinis riding these robots in, and these robots are fighting. And it's like a dinner show. People are sitting there eating dinner. And this was quite a while ago because Anthony Bourdain has been deceased for a few years. So the idea of Sunny really isn't super off, you know, the beaten path, when literally even today, the robots that are probably fighting now are even better than the ones that Anthony Bourdain said. But you could go for your own, you know, dinner theater of fighting robots. So what is it kind of commenting on about technology, or how even humans interact with technology? Because if Sunny's trying to communicate with her, it's almost like she's trying not to say it's a person, but you get into this pattern, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think, well, sci-fi has like some pretty distinctive features. Typically, we'll think about, like, you know, maybe flying cars or like really intense different technology. But the fact that it's so close, and I think you're making a really good point that this is really not so far off, I think. Having, and you know, I have a little robot that lives in my house and cleans my floors when I ask it to, you know, my little Roomba will go around and suck up all the dirt on my floor. So we're not too far off, I think, from having something similar to what we see in this show, especially like they make mention of self-driving cars in the show as well. And so, yeah, the technology thing is really the point of contact here for this kind of sci-fi element to the show. But the difference is right now we have some high functioning robots, but they're not like domestic robots in the same way that we see them. And so, yeah, they might be a dinner theater of robots fighting in some parts of the world, but they're also like, I don't follow super closely all of the tech innovations, but you know, there are different ways that robots move that they've kind of worked on recently, where I don't know if you've seen that kind of look like dog-like robots that kind of move and can jump over different terrain and stuff. So there, I know that there's a lot of development in this field that has been going on for a long time. But in the show, we have these robots that, and the unique thing is that Masa, Susie's husband, is working on robots that will help people out of isolation. So they're meant to be not only high functioning in that they can do a lot of stuff, but they are also meant to be emotional in a way that is unique and maybe more future thinking than what we have at the moment. So they're meant to like bond with people. And we see like in the lab that Masa has, there's a man who has been in isolation for many, many years. And the first contact he has with anybody kind of outside of himself for a long time is a robot who is kind of introduced in isolation with him. And, you know, they end up like hugging at one point, and it's this big deal because he hasn't had any physical touch in a very long time. So we don't see like the really crazy forward thinking, you know, flying cars or this futuristic kind of dystopian situation, but we see there is an element though that is kind of a little bit more creepy, I think, of a robot that can feel those kind of human emotions and establish like love for someone else or real, what is approximating kind of this human kind of care for someone else. So there is this kind of distinct like glimpse forward about how people might want to use technology. But the problem with technology approximating human emotions is that there's always going to be people who want to use that kind of good, it's intended for good, right? This good technology for bad purposes. And that's where we see the whole, there's this whole plot line that we kind of, you know, running at the same time throughout the show of the mob in Japan wanting to use robots to hurt people.
Yakuza.
That's yeah, the Yakuza. And so they want this, they want to use this technology in order to like program and harm people through these robots. And that's where the whole manual comes in that has all of the different codes you can have to make robots murderous or, you know, harm people. And so trying to use these kind of technological advancements for not only personal gain, we see like, we see different people in the Yakuza who want or who are vying for power. And the way that they're doing that is through these like problematic uses of technology. And yeah, it there's also this kind of concern of when robot relationships kind of replace human interaction rather than facilitate it. And I think Masa's intention when he was creating robots was to facilitate human interaction through the use of robots. But the problem is a lot of these people are kind of using it to replace human interaction. And I think one of the key ways that we see that in the show too, and you know, there is a little bit of sordid content in this show. So, but we see that there, a lot of the things in the Dark Manual are also kind of like sexual things. And so we see when Mixie's character first shows up, the friend of Susie, she's talking about like how you can have these codes and have sex with your robot. And it's weird, but that is one misuse of good technology that could happen. So when technology replaces human interaction, I think that's also like a really interesting way that this show comments on kind of our abuse of technology in the future.
Yes. And unfortunately, some of the things they have this manual that you mentioned, it's something that they're searching for in the Dark Manual in this show that mentions that. Unfortunately, some people are probably already down the path of doing those kinds of things as well right now.
Oh, surely. Yeah.
That's unfortunate. The other thing that's really interesting is I wondered if they had done their research, the writers, and I don't know if these are writers in America. I'm assuming people usually have consultants, but there's extended scenes of the Yakuza in the public bath, and all the Yakuza are covered with tattoos. But yes, actually in Japan, it's illegal to go. If you have a tattoo, even for foreigners, you cannot go to the public baths. I mean, the public baths seem weird to us, but in Asia, whether it's in Korea or Japan, that's how people take a bath. So they're separated by ones for men and ones for women. And you feel like it's bizarre in what it seems like a very proper type of culture in Korea and Japan that people go to these public baths and are walking around with no clothes on, going to the bath in the sauna with all these strangers. But literally, that's like a thing that they do. And so I thought that was interesting that they had this some scenes there. And I was just like, this is not realistic because it's literally against the law to go if you have tattoos because of the Yakuza. So I guess the Yakuza must have tattoos, but it's against the law. You would be kicked out for sure. And so foreigners who have tattoos can't go there.
Wow.
Yeah, that's interesting. I found that out recently. So in the story, in Sunny, you mentioned that Suzy Sakamoto's husband, his name is Masa, and they first meet, of course, in a bar. And one of their conversations is about being lonely. And there's something in Japan, it's this specific thing that started there, but I think it's kind of spreading or has spread as people have gotten to know about it. It's called hikikomori, and it's a lifestyle where particularly men, sometimes women, but it's mostly majority men, where they retreat from society. They become hermits. And I think also their parents really, I don't know if they enable them, but it's people who stay in their rooms and literally never come out. I mean, any of our listeners, if you're interested, there's various different documentaries on YouTube that you can watch about this. I've heard about it years ago, but it is something that is very real, and they might be in there for years into their own bedroom at their parents' house. It's very odd, but they don't have any kind of interaction. So they had this conversation about hikikomori. And so can you kind of just tell us a little bit more than just kind of the overview that I gave, but how does the hikikomori lifestyle relate to Susie's husband, Masa, and his character?
So when they first meet, when Suzy and Masa meet, one of their first conversations is this, you know, Masa kind of asking Suzy, well, what are you doing here? Like, why are you in Japan in the first place? And she said, like, she had been having a lot of strained relationships, and we get glimpses of that throughout the series. We don't really know what happened with her prior to moving to Japan, but she's made it pretty clear that she had some pretty difficult relationship stuff.
It's like falling out with a best friend. And I don't know that the series really confirms what it is, but whatever it was pretty traumatic for her and very, I think, for the other person, like, I don't ever want to even see you or hear about you again.
Yes. And in some ways, it almost seems like that may have been romantic too. There are a few, like, offhanded comments that make it seem like it may have been more than just a friendship, but I'm not sure. I think that they don't spell it out on purpose, because I think that might have been something that they were planning on revealing later, maybe. But the point is, she's kind of reeling from this trauma of a broken relationship of whatever kind it is. And she says that this hikikomori lifestyle, this life in isolation, is appealing to her. And Masa says, oh, I lived as hikikomori for 3 years. And the story he tells people, different people, is different. So we see when he first tells Suzy about his isolation, his 3 year isolation in his bedroom, he says that it was, you know, when his dad died, that's when he went into isolation. And when Suzy is at Masa's funeral, one of his friends says, oh, and it was his father who helped him out of isolation, which seems backwards, but we find out later that there's this whole other, you know, it turns out that his father growing up was not his real father. And so it is, both are true, but basically that hikikomori is like, the word itself is this portmanteau of words, hiki, which means like to withdraw, and komori, to be inside. So it, like, it has this broad meaning of people who withdraw from society, but there's this more specific reference to people who self-isolate for longer than 6 months in their homes, or sometimes rooms specifically, and refuse to leave. So Masa's story of his isolation is unique in the way that he still has a job. He works online remotely for this technology company. And that's unique because a lot of the people who do live this hikikomori lifestyle are no longer working. They're just kind of living off of their relatives who are taking care of them. So
who just,
that's unique.
Literally leave food at their door, and then they just open the door, get the food, and, you know, close the door.
Yes. And it's interesting. I have watched a few of these documentaries on YouTube about this, and there are some people who do like have their own apartment and live this kind of lifestyle. So they must be taking advantage of all of the food delivery services because I don't know how else you'd eat if you didn't leave your house. But yeah, so there's this
They
other.
don't leave their house. There's so many, like in Japan, it's not the same thing that we do here, but like the 7-Elevens in Japan are like really bougie and people eat there all the time and just get all this to-go food. So I understand not having human interaction. Maybe they don't even want to have human interaction with the person checking them out, but I don't even think that you need a person checking you out. That's kind of, it's very interesting about how Japan has innovations. Like one of their brands of clothing that has come to the United States, Uniqlo, when you go there, I mean, they do have places where people are checking you out, but if you go to the one in Hawaii, there's no person working the register. It just, you put the clothes in this bin area and it, you're not even scanning the thing. You just dump it in there. It knows how many items it is, what the items are, and it charges you for them. And then you
Wow.
put it in a bag and leave. I don't understand how they do that because you're not even scanning the little tag. You don't need to. You just put it in this little bin thing and it like weighs it or knows or can sense it. And so that's surprising to me that they won't even go out because Japan has made so many innovations where you don't have to interact with anyone.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it's beyond just not wanting to be around people. Especially watching some of those documentaries where you see kind of the life of a lot of these people living in isolation, there it's beyond just not wanting to see people. It's this kind of self like punishment or something. A lot of these people just seem like they want to stay in isolation because they deserve it or something. But the hikikomori is not just a Japanese phenomenon. We see this kind of popping up all over the world. And you mentioned this earlier, but, and it is more men than women, but a lot of these people are like, it's something like 1.4 million people in Japan living in isolation and like over 200,000 living in Korea that they have confirmed. And now there's this new kind of term called extreme social withdrawal, which is typically what we use in America. So we're not using the term hikikomori in the same way, but this extreme social withdrawal also is present in America. I think the internet really enables a lot of that. The fact that you can still maintain quote unquote social interactions, but never have to leave your house.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have been possible in previous generations. I think you need technology, and I think you also need to be able to work remotely. But it's, and because of like the ability with the internet to not limit, because these folks play video games too.
Yes.
So they could be playing video games and interacting with people that way, but they just don't want to see people, you know, IRL in the flesh somehow. Or maybe they're playing solitary video games because that's possible too. But I don't know that in past or, you know, hundreds of years ago, you wouldn't have had the means to be able to maintain the hikikomori lifestyle. I don't think.
I don't think so either. And I think COVID, a lot of the literature that I was reading about this too, COVID really amped this up a lot because we had more systems pop up that allowed for an isolated lifestyle in order to, you know, stay safe from the virus. A lot of people just kind of retreated and stayed there. So we have more options for delivery for food. We have more options for online, quote unquote, like communities. We have more opportunities to just be isolated in like in a prolonged amount of time. So there is something to that as well, that COVID has sort of made this worse.
Are there any, I guess, universal features of hikikomori? Because you mentioned that it's in Korea, it's now in the United States and other places. Is there something, a profile maybe, of somebody who would pursue this kind of lifestyle?
Yes. So there's a big correlation for people who seek out this kind of lifestyle, those who have psychiatric conditions, it's not a one-to-one causation kind of thing, but there's definite correlation between psychiatric conditions and maladaptive personality traits that show up in people who tend to isolate in this way. A lot of it has to do with adverse family dynamics, especially the people who have parents who are really overbearing or really enabling this kind of lifestyle as well. We see with a lot of these people negative peer experiences, all of the societal pressures. And I think that this is why we see it so much in Japan, is this work culture that you were talking about earlier. This idea that your life revolves around work. And if you don't feel like you fit in at work, or you don't feel like the kind of work that you're being pressured to have from your family is the right choice for you, it can be easier to just shut down and withdraw than it is to lean in and force yourself to be uncomfortable all the time. As I mentioned, you know, excessive internet use or digital media use is also one of the key features of people who isolate in this extreme way. But I think the biggest thing, and it seemed to be throughout all of the scientific literature, is coping difficulties. So if there are any challenges that are presented in, you know, the lives of these people, they have a hard time coping and adapting. And it's easier, it's perceived to be easier to just not deal with it. So,
and the character of Masa Sakamoto, his mom fits that profile of the overbearing mother, or at least that's how she came across to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, relationship difficulties with them as well. She is secretive and she's obviously hiding things from him. And yeah, and there are difficulties, you know, he has perceived difficulties with his father that he grew up with. And yeah, I think that plays into some of the other things like low self-esteem and some of the other like kind of factors like that, that play into the hikikomori lifestyle. So, but definitely you see Masa's mom leaving food outside of his door and begging him to come out, and he won't come out. And so it's difficult to say that there's like a one size fits all kind of profile of people who tend to do this. But I think the biggest thing, the biggest kind of feature, is this difficulty coping. Either there's some kind of event that happens or psychiatric things that are kind of underlying under the surface, or peer pressure, societal pressure, whatever, but not feeling like you can cope, feeling like you're stuck and just choosing to not deal with those things rather than be uncomfortable and deal with them.
So because this is featured in this series, because Masa Sakamoto is pursuing this lifestyle, at one point we find out in the series, you wonder, how do people stop isolating in this extreme fashion? So are there ways that people who are specialists, I mean, outside of what the series is portraying, how do they encourage people to get out of this lifestyle? Because like we mentioned, some of it could be enabled by a parent who is worried but would rather have their child, even if it's an adult child. That's the other thing I want to say, is some of these people are adults into their 30s, and we see them in the documentaries. That's what you kind of think, oh, is it some kid or somebody who's, you know, college age that starts getting into this? But one of the surprising things to me was to see older folks really living this lifestyle. So how do specialists say that people can get out of it if they want to get out of it? I'm assuming that they do. I don't know, you know, we're not going to be able to analyze why people are in this besides kind of some overviews that you've given us, but is there a way to effectively have people leave this lifestyle and then be reintegrated into relationships?
Yeah. So actually it's interesting that you bring up the age thing, because there is this new phenomenon that they're now calling the 80-50 phenomenon in Japan, where there are a lot of 80-year-old parents taking care of 50-year-old children. So, and they're a big portion of the people who are living the hikikomori lifestyle. So there, it goes even beyond 30s. Like, there are people who are fully grown adults who are living in isolation and having their 80-year-old parents take care of them. So it's very odd. But yeah, so I think what the biggest things that people suggest for leaving this kind of extreme isolation, the practical things would be like finding some kind of self-reliance, becoming involved in your family environment, because a lot of these people live with their family. There are some very practical, like, small ways that you can start integrating people into family life that forces them to be outside of their room. So cooking meals, taking care of plants, having a garden, doing something outside and not just inside the house. Working to gain confidence seems to be one of the main things. So because a lot of the people who choose to isolate in this way feel like they don't fit in or feel like they can't cultivate the relationships that they want, working to gain confidence is a big piece of that. So that can be like maybe serving others. That is like one of the main things that people suggest for feeling less lonely on the whole. But serving others tends to bring with it this sense of purpose that people are really looking for when they need like human interaction. It's not just, I need stuff from other people, but the act of serving others really informs how we interact with other people and gives us some self-purpose. But yeah, becoming responsible and being interested in the things around you can really help draw you out of isolation. In Japan, they actually have quite a few of these kind of halfway houses that people live in who are, because this is such a problem, the people who are coming out of the hikikomori lifestyle, it's almost like a drug rehab halfway house where people will live in community and start to integrate back into society. And so people who are struggling with isolation, kind of forced to live in a community together, forced to cook together, to clean together. And some of them even have like jobs that are kind of associated with that home. So they have to be out in the community doing things. That can be really, really helpful for a lot of people. Just being in a situation where they're intentionally living in community can be a big difference. It can make a big difference.
And in Japan, because this has become almost a like crisis of so many people opting into this, is they have people who literally, that's their ministry or their, you know, nonprofit organization that specializes in starting to make initial contact. So you see in some of these documentaries, it's like the parents are like, can you even make contact? So it's a long, slow process, just like regularly coming to that person's door if they live in their house and just in like their parents' house and then trying to talk to them. And it takes a long time before they even receive an answer. You know, yes. So it was very fascinating that it's become an industry almost of people who are trying to help the hikikomori and also get them to reintegrate into society.
Yeah. And it's interesting. They found that women do a better job of kind of coaxing these men out of these situations than other men. Because you would think that like having peer relationships with other men might help draw a lot of these guys out of isolation. But there's something comforting, I guess, that they talked about in one of those documentaries that I watched. It seems like they really want connection with women, which is interesting.
Also women that aren't their mother.
Yes.
The character that we find in Sunny is Masa's mother, who's still kind of berating him to me, even as he's living this hikikomori lifestyle. So when his character, Masa, becomes starting to leave his hikikomori isolation, in other words, he's realizing, I shouldn't be doing this, the series introduces this trash robot that he's programming, and it helps him think through that, oh, I need some kind of interaction with something, someone. And so it's very controversial, but as we've been talking about this whole episode, you know, just what, how do robots interact with humans? And it shows us about AI. I mean, maybe we say it was prophetic to have that film all those years ago, her, about that AI that was interacting with the character, the Joaquin Phoenix character, voiced by Scarlett Johansson. But actually, because, and by the way, just to tell some of our listeners, is that AI can be used in positive ways as well. And so when you hear an AI voice now, it's actually a human voice that has been mapped. So they've used, that's why, I don't know if anybody sees, you know, various different ads on social media, but one time I saw an ad for audio Bibles, and I guess Snoop Dogg has allowed his voice to be mapped. So you could pay a subscription and get Snoop Dogg to read the Bible to you. I mean,
wow.
Very interesting experience. And that's why, for instance, if anyone uses the Waze app, it's a very popular app for driving and maps, but it's fascinating because of technology. Waze is located in Israel, so they're mapping everything in the United States. And, you know, if you want to pop onto Waze, it's a little bit more interactive because users will tell you why something is stopped or this traffic is still stopped for this long or whatever. But anyway, on Waze in the past, I don't know if it's still there, you could pick a different voice, and you can do that now. You can pick on your Android or your Apple, what kind of voice do you want speaking to you? And they don't sound robotic because they aren't robotic, because they're human voices that have been mapped. Some of them are robotic, but a lot of them now, you would not know that they're automated voices if they're edited properly. So they can do all kinds of things to be very realistic sounding because it is literally a human voice speaking. So that's something I wanted to ask, like, what does it show just on a lay level about how potentially humans can interact with and respond to AI, you know, robots in the case of Sunny, this domestic, I mean, she looks very robotic. She doesn't look real, like we would think of, you know, futuristic sci-fi. It looks like a person, but this is a very robotic looking thing, but it has this voice that's soothing and programmed to Susie specifically. So what can we learn about that in terms of how we might interact with a robot?
Yeah, I think there's the instance with Masa leaving his isolation. He starts to find purpose as he's programming this trash robot. And there's this really powerful moment when, because of the adaptive learning, the AI kind of learning that the trash robot has, as Masa's training him to distinguish between trash and not trash, which is the whole purpose of a trash robot, the robot identifies something very unique and interesting about Masa, which is you always frown at things that are not trash. You want to keep things that make you feel bad. And in that moment, Masa realizes this thing about him, which is, I'm in this kind of problematic cycle where I'm keeping all of this negativity, and I'm cyclically kind of ending up in this bad, vicious cycle of me wanting things that make me feel bad. So it took this AI trash robot interaction of identifying something that was true about him, but external to him, to Masa, that identified his problem in a way that was unique. And so there's been a lot written on AI and how we can kind of use it in a positive way and not in a replacing human interaction kind of way. But in this particular situation, we see this trash robot like take all of the input that it saw and come up with something that was actually kind of insightful, and identifying a pattern in Masa's life that he didn't necessarily recognize himself. And so it wasn't just that there was this purpose that Masa found in developing the technology and creating this bot to do what it was supposed to do better, but it was also this like insight that he was living this kind of bad, in this bad way, where he was just being like beating up on himself all the time. And so the big thing that we see that's kind of a problem with this AI kind of robot like relationships with humans is that when these robots started to form emotional attachments, that seemed to be the biggest problem, because that's when the robots would act outside of their programming to protect others. So we see with Sunny, when she's in the lab with Masa, if she perceived that there was a threat, she became violent. And that happened with other robots too. And so, and that kind of like is the whole thing behind why the book of this kind of bad coding exists in the first place, because they would program away these bad things that the robots could do. But they didn't exist until the robots decided to act those ways. So anyway, I think it's interesting how we see with Masa not only the purpose and connection he gets from just having programmed something that works well, but also this kind of AI learning as it perceives us and our patterns and humans doing what they're doing, they can offer some insight that can be helpful. And so that is promising in some way, but also kind of creepy, I think, a little bit.
Well, I certainly hope kind of a deeper dive on the subjects that come up in this TV series makes some of our listeners want to watch it. Like you said, there's a, I think it is rated R for language and a lot of, you know, drinking, and there's a few sexual situations. They're brief, but maybe, you know, if you're watching it, you'll skip those. But really, how is this series, because it is popular, our listeners will come across people who, and also it's popular, just generally it was popular on Apple TV this summer. It was in the top 25 of shows that were being watched. That's why it came up for me. These are our top shows. And I'm like, oh, I like sci-fi. I might like this. Oh, it says comedy. I don't know why it's listed as comedy. It's very dark black comedy, if that. But it definitely can be a springboard just of all the that we were talking about. And as our listeners may know, and we will link it in the show notes, Lisa has written for us on loneliness in the past. So as the Christian apologist thinks about this series, how are we supposed to, as Christians, relate to others and have relationships? And also, as you know, Christianity notes, you know, we are sinners. We live in a broken world. And so relationships are not easy. And there's the calling that Christians have to have relationships that reflect who Christ is a very high calling, and it is very difficult. And we are not immune to all the ways in which we see these characters struggle in broken relationships. But first of all, how are we supposed to build them as Christians? How can we encourage other people as we share Christ that they're just thinking, well, other people don't treat me this way? And how is it really different from the way in which AI can interact with us? I think we deceive ourselves when we think that the AI has any kind of human interaction with us, even though it can answer a lot of questions. If anyone is using ChatGPT, about a year ago or more when ChatGPT started, it wasn't very smart. But now ChatGPT is very smart because the AI programming has learned so much in more than a year that if you get the ChatGPT app and you talk to ChatGPT, again, it has a human sounding voice because it's a human voice mapped, and you can literally almost have a conversation with, not almost, you can have a conversation with ChatGPT. It's very helpful, and it's a lot smarter than if you ask Google or Siri or Alexa anything. And so it seems like you're speaking to a human being on the other end. So how should we be cautious about how we maybe start interacting with AI, and how do we, in such a broken world when we're hurt, interact with others?
Yeah, there's a very interesting thing about the idea of like forging some kind of relationship with robots. Like robots don't have an eternal soul. They're not created in the image of God. They are man-made, which means that they cannot have the same kind of standing as other humans. And yet, like as people relating to other people, we have this very beautiful and important relationship with one another, which is we recognize that we're created in the image of God. And the Bible gives us all of these great exhortations to, you know, to relationships. So like, you know, iron sharpens iron. So like the idea that when you're in a relationship, you're actually helping each other grow and be better people. And, you know, the exhortations to like keep loving one another earnestly, and love covers a multitude of sins. Even though there's sin in the world, and even though there are problematic relationships, and we're all gonna end up with some kind of sin toward one another, and our relationships are not gonna be perfect, they're still more fulfilling and better because we have this basis of not only personhood, but also as Christians, we recognize that when we sin against one another, we can repent and we can forgive one another because of what Jesus Christ has done for us in dying for us and rising from the dead, in securing for us eternal life. We have something that's much more hopeful, this promise of everlasting life with Christ forever and all those who believe. So we're going to be in relationship even into eternity, relationships with others. And so that, I think, is where we derive our hope from. That's where we derive our purpose from, that when we're called into community and we're called to love and service of each other, we're called to this forgiveness and restoration of broken relationships, that enables us to use our gifts and talents to help one another, to support one another. And in those moments when we're, you know, isolated, grieving, feeling lonely, any of those things, like when we have those relationships created and sustained, that really can help us like move forward through those tough situations in a way that you're not going to get from AI or, you know, a robot or something. Like you're not going to have the same kind of give and take in a relationship.
How would a Christian encourage the person, though, that says, who's not a Christian, who says, but the relationships in my life have been toxic, my relationships with my parents have been toxic, or not only that, but now I'm divorced, or whatever it is, or my parents hurt me, and I know my grandparents hurt my parents, that kind of thing. How do you encourage them? Because those people, and maybe they're also introverted, too. Like, it sounds good to them to be hikikomori. That sounds like it would be just an ideal situation. I wouldn't have to deal with people that are mean, and I could just, you know, do DoorDash or Uber Eats right to my door, and I don't have to deal with other people.
It's so hard because I know like relationships are really, really tough, and you really can be so deeply harmed by others in a way that you're not necessarily going to be harmed by like social situations or just, you know, more broad kind of cultural things. Like people can really take the knowledge that they have of you in a specific way and hurt you very specifically. And so the people who are dealing with those things, like, I would like to acknowledge how difficult that is before giving an answer. There are very pointed and difficult ways that people have to wrestle through emotional and physical hurt that happens from close relationships. But that doesn't mean that opting out is better. Opting out just means that you have, when in those moments when you do need support, you don't have it. And it can be really hard to cultivate trust. It can be really hard to start stepping out in faith, knowing that there are others out there who need connection just like you do. But it can be restorative. And I think especially like the ideal situation is that Christians are going to do what they say they do, right? So we talk this big game of being forgiving and loving and, you know, kind and this kind of redemptive view of friendship. And yet oftentimes we fail and routinely fail these things. But hopefully, you know, where there is forgiveness and repentance and an actual turning away from those problematic behaviors, there can be good and healthy, restorative relationships. And so I would encourage whoever is struggling, who is in isolation or would lean more toward isolation, being involved in a church community, especially one that is multi-generational, can really be restorative. So the people who have problematic relationships with their parents, knowing other people who are older than you, who take an interest in you and care about your life and will pray over you and, you know, help you when you're hurting, that can be so redemptive. So it's not just those peer relationships that are really, really helpful, but sometimes cultivating those cross-generational relationships can really like fill that kind of need in someone's life. So my encouragement would just be, it's not worth opting out. It's worth trying, even when it's hard. And it's sad and difficult, and it's hard to trust people, but it can get better. But it can't get better if you don't even try.
And also, you know, as Christians, we believe that God has created us to be in relationships fundamentally.
Yes.
Even before the world was broken, relationship with God primarily, but also not just primarily, only that, relationships with one another since Adam was created, and it wasn't good for him to be alone. And he didn't have relational needs met by just tending and working and caring for the garden and naming animals. So he needed someone else to relate to in addition to God. And so that's something I think that is a core thing of, because the Trinity itself is in relationship, of Christianity, that we can talk to others about. And also, can you tell us how a Christian worldview will help us, you know, combat this isolation and loneliness and also despair when we have been hurt by other people? Or in the character Susie Sakamoto's case, she was drowning in grief at the time. We won't give all the spoilers and tell you the entire series, so you have to watch it to see some of the other things that are happening there, because I think this is a good springboard to just watch the series because there's a lot there, but also knowing that it's rated R. You know, how can a Christian worldview do that? And Lisa's our writer who did a deep dive for us on this subject matter. So, you know, we did note that even the government itself right now, we've been told that this is a crisis. This is an epidemic of loneliness. I know that there's a specific government post in the UK, but even the Surgeon General in the United States wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about how do we combat loneliness. And I thought it was really fascinating because some of the ways he said to combat loneliness, I'm thinking that's exactly what the church does.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my key takeaway, is that Christianity gives us all of the resources to combat loneliness in a very meaningful way. And I think the secular world is looking at this problem and going, how are we going to fix this? And they've run all these tests, they've done all these surveys, and they come up with the Christian answer, which is like, you need hope that goes beyond just your present circumstance. As Christians, we have this beautiful hope for the future. And it's not just, you know, our immediate circumstances. It's not a health and wealth kind of hope, but it transcends our present circumstances. We have this eternity that we're looking forward to that is without sin, in the presence of God, new heavens, new earth. We're all in restored relationships. That is the hope that we have. And that informs a lot of how we can live our life, you know, this side of heaven. We're called into community. That's the other thing that constant, you know, secular harping on, just find community, make connections with people. Christians have a community that regularly meets every single week. We have, all you have to do is look up your local churches and find one that, you know, they have their time on their website. You show up and you're in community. Like, there are people there who want to fellowship with you. Your love and service of others, that's a huge deal. When you have opportunities to serve others, it gives you purpose, it gives you connection to others. The idea of forgiveness and restoration, that when we have broken relationships with one another, we have the tools we need to fix those relationships and not just opt out. And, you know, when we're dealing with grief, when we lose people we love, there is this hope for reunification with those people in heaven. So we don't have to despair that we've lost people. There is hope, even in those very particular circumstances. And then as Christians, we also have a very important and meaningful purpose as Christians to live our lives in our vocations with others. So as we see how we relate to one another, you know, as a parent or as a child or as a coworker or however you're relating to one another, there's purpose and there's meaning in how we see our work in the world and how we interact with others. And so glorifying God in the work that we do this side of heaven is something that gives us purpose and helps us move forward to combat that kind of loneliness or purposelessness that comes with isolation.
And I think that Christians should remember, if you're a Christian and thinking about this more, you know, this has resonated with you, this topic, more than a springboard to, at this point in your life, to share Christ with others. I would say that the church is not a perfect place. I mean, that's a cliche, but one of the things is to serve other people. That's what Christ calls us to. And also to remember that Christ himself, as he lived a perfect life on this earth, experienced relational pain. He asked his disciples to stay up with him when he was in his greatest hour of need in the garden, and they didn't. Peter had denied Christ. So remembering also who Jesus is, yes, he's God, and he's also man, and he has experienced the same relational pains, but that did not prevent him from pursuing others or ministering to other people. And I think we need to keep that in mind, because there, as we live in this fallen world now, this side of the earth being resurrected when Jesus returns, everything being made new, is that we will experience relational pain. But how do we not wallow in that like the hikikomori and ask the Lord by the power of the Holy Spirit to help move us on? As a matter of fact, I have more than 2,000 people in my church, so no one will know who I'm talking about. And also, I don't remember her name, but we have quite a few widows at our church, I think more than 100. And I was recently in a situation seated at a table with a lady who was just finally feeling like she could come back out into being involved in church. And her husband died 10 years ago. And she said, I've just come to the realization, I feel like I've wasted away 10 years. Yeah. And so just try to, you know, really ask the Lord to help you to make that, you know, step of faith. And I know that's hard, because a lot of times we go to a place, and of course the church is full of all kinds of people. That's the thing. Jesus has saved all kinds of people who are not like us, who don't have our same interests. But what does it mean to be a friend, to love people well, to be that person of humility that serves others? Because I think as American Christians, I tend to do this too. You go to church and you think of like, well, what does it have for me? What is it going to do for me? What do I want from it? Even if we have certain theological leanings, like, you know, oh, I definitely know I want to go to like a liturgical church or this kind of church or this particular denomination or whatever. I think we all have those kinds of things. But if we don't immediately meet people who are like us, maybe we'd say, oh, well, I don't want to come back. But try to be involved in the life of the church, because friendships and relationships that do provide meaningful connection don't happen overnight. It's not just quality, but it's also quantity and proximity. So get involved in a small group that is maybe from your church in your neighborhood or your area, so you're not driving like, you know, 30, 45 minutes, an hour away to go to one. So those are just some of the things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I hope this conversation was very interesting, as we've talked about relationships and loneliness. But on a much lighter note, Lisa, it's January, so I don't know if you're the resolution type. Do you make resolutions, or do you poo-poo them? And if you do make them, do you have any resolution that you would like to pursue for 2025?
It's so interesting. The idea of making resolutions is something that I like to do throughout the year. I don't like to just say, well, this is just going to be my 2025. But I think one of the big things that I'm working on this year, and so is my husband, is we're working on having a better relationship with technology, which, you know, ties into our talk today. I think especially, you know, I've written on scrolling and doom scrolling for the Christian Research Journal as well. And I'm finding more and more that just my, I don't like that my silent moments in the day are taken up by technology. So I'm really trying to recapture those quiet moments in between things. And so that is probably my biggest resolution this year, is to kind of step away from that constant compulsion to have my phone with me at all times and to be constantly connected. So I'm hoping, you know, I like to think that I have a decent relationship with technology, but I'm hoping that as I am more intentional about it, that I'll see that time, that kind of quiet time, recaptured.
And also, speaking of technology, technology also allows you to actually look and see how long you've been on it.
So exactly.
That could be. And also, for people who want to pursue that resolution in their own life, a lot of apps will, you can, speaking of AI, program it to tell, you know, to say shut it down or turn it off or quit it after, if I'm on it for more than 5 minutes or whatever it is. So
yeah.
Technology even provides us the tools to manage our own technology and make our technology usage less. Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to episode 427 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Lisa Cooper, and she has written a TV series review for the Christian Research Journal. Her review is called Grief, Loneliness, Friendship, and Robots, How Apple TV Plus's Sunny Shows Us About Human Nature. And you can read her article for free without a paywall at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.